Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It was chaos because all of the, you know, the Aussies were everywhere. Some were on the right, some were on the left, some were down the middle. They needed to get the ball back. We were trying to cover all bases and then they kicked it off quick.
Welcome back. In 1998, England halfback Matt Dawson went on tour to Australia, New Zealand and South Africa as captain of the national side. Labelled the tour from hell, thrashed in every test, lessons were learned and 5 years later they would return down under as the number one rugby team on the planet and become world champions. This is the story of how they rebuilt from the ashes to lift the William Webb Ellis Trophy. Before we get started, AG1 are supporting us again this episode. I'm a massive fan of AG1, not just because they support the podcast, but because it makes it super easy for me to get all the nutrients I need each day in just one easy hit. I take one spoon every morning and it means I don't have to worry about taking a bunch of different things. I can just mix one scoop of powder in water once a day. Couldn't be easier. AG1 replaces your multivitamin, your probiotic, in just one simple drinkable habit. And if you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to ag1.com/AndyRowe. That's ag1.com/AndyRowe. I've also got a massive announcement for me and for the podcast. The Andy Rowe Show has partnered up with Buffalo Trace to announce our first ever series of live shows in London. I'm so pumped about this. Every show is set in an intimate setting. So think maximum 40 tickets to be sold for each venue, sitting around, having a whiskey, hearing some stories, a bit of audience interaction as well. The guest lineup has already been confirmed with some of our favourite previous guests already locked in. Each show will have two guests and will involve, as I said, some audience interaction as well if you fancy asking some questions, but you don't have to. So we've got undercover football hooligan James Bannon, SAS veteran Nigel Ealy, Red Arrows and Top Gun pilot Dan Lowes, Chinook chick Liz McConaughey, the prison governor, Vanessa Frake, rogue warrior, Denny Denham, sex cult escapee, Bexy Cameron, and of course, we've got the futurist, Matt Griffin. The first show is on Wednesday, the 12th of July at the Marquee of Westminster in Victoria. Then we go to the Eagle in Ladbroke Grove on Wednesday, the 26th of July. The following month, we're at the Grafton in Kentish Town on August the 9th. And then our final show in the series will be August 23rd at the Duchess, just off Oxford Street. Check out my social media for more information or just go to Design My Night and search Andy Rowe to get your tickets before they sell out. As I said, very intimate location. Not many tickets are going on sale. They're only 15 quid and you get a free Buffalo Trace cocktail or Warner's Gin and Tonic with that as well. This episode was organised by the legends at Sports Travel and Hospitality UK. STH is an official hospitality sales agent for the Rugby World Cup in France. They can help you purchase hospitality packages for this year's tournament. Just visit sthuk.com or click on the link, which I'll put in the description of this episode. Hope you enjoy the episode.
Matt Dawson, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure to be on the show.
You could have played for Chelsea Football Club.
Played for Chelsea Schoolboys, playing rugby at the weekend on a Saturday, and then Sunday I'd play football for Flackwell Heath. And then I got sort of scouted by a mate's dad who was, I think he was on the board at Chelsea at that time. It was the school said to me, you're going to have to stop that. One, there's too much homework going to be coming your way. We're a rugby school. You've got to focus on your rugby. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Move on.
And then how did that progress to you? You ended up in New Zealand.
That was when I was probably 19. And back then, the off-season, you'd finish, wouldn't really go too far into May. There'd be a little bit of sevens, then you'd have, you know, quite a significant couple of months off before the season would start again. A lot of the time, those younger players who maybe looked like they could be, you know, England under 20s or that sort of thing, we would all disappear and play in the Southern Hemisphere. particularly Australia and New Zealand. So I went down and had 3 months with a club called Te Awamutu.
Te Awamutu.
Yeah. And played with a coach who was a guy called John Sisley. He was mates with my Northampton coach called Glenn Ross. Lived with Glenn Ross in Hamilton for a couple of weeks and then moved to RD3 and was living in the absolute, well, as it is, rural District 3, middle of nowhere, climbing up trees, pruning trees with chainsaws.
My God.
Fire, you know, those petrol tanks on the, like in a backpack with a jet spray that would like get, you know, you'd be like absolutely burning the fields apart. And then Tuesday and Thursday nights, we'd be going down to Te Awamutu to train and then have a boiled sausage and a bit of bread and a couple of beers, then get in the truck, get in the ute back on a Tuesday and Thursday night, always stop on the same corner, grab a crowbar, put the headlights on the ute, and it would start all the turkeys on the fence, and you'd creep around the back of the turkeys and
nick a turkey for dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you think like that kind of part of your rugby development impacted you in the long run?
Yeah, it was a tremendous life experience, you know, outside of the rugby. But rugby-wise, it was senior rugby. I was playing, you know, men's rugby, and it was tough. You know, it was uncompromising week to week. Great standard. Played with a couple of, you know, sort of then weren't All Blacks at the time, but then would go into, you know, be All Blacks. Strawbridge, Foster. Foster was my fly half at Te Awamutu. It was a real good education to then come back. It took me really from that schoolboy under 19 rugby to, you know, ready to play senior rugby.
And then fast forward to 1998, you go back to New Zealand, you go back to Australia, you go back to South Africa, the tour from hell. Another big moment of rugby development for you, not just for you, but for England as well, because you were captain.
Yeah, England. I mean, New Zealand was always a tough place to go. So then going down in 98, being captain. Yeah, I was injured to start with, so I was fighting to get fit, but then, you know, wanted to play in these games, played in a midweek game, then in the test match, but, you know, getting absolutely hammered. Yeah, we had a second, third string England side, none of the, you know, Martin Johnsons, Delalios, Richard Hill, none of those guys were around. You know, it was a very young, naive team going into the bear pit, and, you know, we got found out. But within that group, there were maybe half a dozen players that really stood up and put their name on the rugby map there. And certainly Clive, I think, looked at about half a dozen players to say, you know, I can absolutely take you anywhere. If you can come out of that trip with your head held high and a bit of reputation enhanced, then, you know, you're the right type of character for me going forward. So as much as there were a lot of players that maybe didn't play for England again, there were a lot of players there that absolutely kick-started their career.
Could you tell the people that weren't going to make it?
Certainly, looking back, there are characteristics within sports people that just sometimes elevate them to a different level to anybody else. And that is the way that they train, the way that they prepare, the way that they mentally they're ready for the game, physically, how they socialise, how they communicate, you know, what's important to them, general energy levels, you know, how they interact with other players. You look back and people like Johnny Wilkinson, Josh Lucy.
The stars that carried on.
Yeah.
You could, when you look back, you can see they were demonstrating those characteristics back in 98.
100%. Yeah, 100%. With those players, they might not have made it to, say, 5 years into the World Cup, but there were players in that team that you knew were going to play for England for a few more years because they had it within them to take themselves to the next level. Yeah,
there was a turning point on that tour, wasn't there, where you guys have been pasted by Australia and New Zealand, and you go to South Africa and you check into a hotel. Clive ended up checking you out of that hotel and into a different one for some reason. Can you sort of talk me through the mentality behind that?
Well, we had got into Cape Town last game of the tour, and it was only a 3-week tour, but we'd been to Australia, New Zealand, two tests in New Zealand, then we flew to South Africa.
Brutal.
It was absolutely horrific. And I remember being on a flight to South Africa and all, and the conversation was, what on earth? Whoever are the governing body, whether it's the RFU or World Rugby or whoever has come up with this, I mean, it's an absolute shambles.
Mm.
And we got into this hotel in Cape Town, actually where the Lions had stayed the year before, but it was an absolute shambles. I mean, what had happened to the place in a year was just remarkable. Anyway, we got in there and we weren't on the same floor and it was all a bit tatty and there was other rugby teams in there and it was a little bit disorganized. But ordinarily, you just get on with it. You know, got a week to go, let's just move on. Whereas Clive just wasn't having it. Clive was like, this is not acceptable because of what the players have done. And then you put them in what is a really tatty hotel. We're moving. The manager at the time was like, we're not moving, Clive. We can't move. We can't afford it. But anyway, Clive went up to the Mount Nelson up on the hill, which is a significantly more starred hotel than the Holiday Inn, and just put his card behind there and said, right, I want however many, 30 rooms or whatever it is. So we all piled in there for the week. And I'd love to say, and then we won the game. We still lost the game. however, I think there was... that was certainly one of the moments where I look back at Clive, and as much as, he made himself open to criticism because, of the nature of the guy, and he was always trying to push the boundaries and all the rest of it. But there were certain moments in my relationship with Clive over the years where you just think that, I mean, you are so focused on success and winning and making the team as best as possible, making your coaching staff as, and that was an example where I don't care about all the results, don't care about what's going on. This is going to give my team a better chance at the weekend. You know, he was absolutely dedicated to success.
Mm.
And he showed that throughout. Going all the way through to the World Cup, it would be so easy for people to think, oh, well, look at all the players he had in the World Cup. Anybody could have coached that. Well, that's just nonsense. Clive created all of that, created the environment with his coaching staff, with the RFU, and him absolutely at the helm to then for us to blossom into our, more experienced mindset that we could own it on the field when he wanted us to own it when we're playing the game, and he would own it away from the field.
So going into the 99 World Cup off the back of that tour in 98, what were your expectations?
Oh, 99, we were convinced we were going to win it.
Really?
Oh yeah. I think looking back, we were deluded, but yeah, I mean, the preparation, the training we did down in Brisbane, we were fully tech. We had our own laptops and we were, on the internet. It was all new. We had our own, file of faxes and kit and, initials everywhere on this. We thought we had it all. We were doing more training than anybody else. But it was just slightly misdirected. It was slightly generic. Rather than going into 03, it was really bespoke and specific to the individual, whether it was their diet or their training regime or their skills. Everything was... right, this is what you need to improve on daily or be good at daily, work on it.
Mm.
Whereas in 99, it was right, okay, all the backs, you're all going to do that amount of fitness and that type of fitness, and forwards, you're doing all of those weights and all of that scrummage. It wasn't as tailored, but we trained ridiculously, but I'm just not sure we trained in a manner that was going to be good enough to win the World Cup. But yeah, as it panned out, we didn't have the strategy and sort of management agility and flexibility on the pitch to beat South Africa quarterfinal, having loads of drop goals. Right, what we're going to do, rather than just concentrating on what we were doing, we should have been creating a plan to negate what South Africa were doing. Whereas
I need to be knocking over five droppies.
Yeah. Whereas you fast forward that to the quarterfinal against Wales, when we were up against it again, half time, absolutely knocked it out of the park, made a substitution, slightly changed the way that we play. Baba had it, second half, done, dusted.
Mm.
Will scores his try in the corner after Robbo's break. It was, and that was game done, drop goals from Johnny. And it was just Whereas 4 years before, we didn't have that capacity to do that.
The 99 World Cup, you guys had a rough run though, because it was so key that you beat New Zealand in the pool play. Otherwise, you get essentially three games in a week leading into a quarterfinal, because you would be the number two in that pool. Mm. That game against New Zealand, I just want to touch on it a little bit, because it was one of the famous Jonah Lomu tries, and you were involved in that. Can you kind of talk me through your perspective on that situation?
Yeah. Well, I was one of many England players to be shrugged off and thrown around like a rag doll by Jonah Lomu. And on that occasion, I mean, funnily enough, I remember in the team run, because Austin Healey was marking Jonah, and Jerry Guscott was taking the mickey out of Austin. He was doing like sort of like flapping around on the floor like a fish, as if to say, you know, this is what's going to be happening against you,
you know, really?
At the weekend, and giving him loads of stick. I'm fairly sure if you look at the clip, Jerry's one of the players that Jonah like shrugs off. And then I jump on him and he shrugs me off, and then we all pile in the corner, but he scored already. But yeah, I mean, Jonah was an incredible athlete. As much as lot was made out, you know, that semi-final in 95 and pool game in 99, there were many, many teams who failed to put Jonah to the sword. He was an incredible, incredible athlete.
Were you in the changing rooms? Was that a true story? It might have been just someone doing an after-dinner speak. Clive was talking about how he wouldn't swap any of your players for a New Zealand player.
That was on the flip chart on the Friday night. And he pulled the first page of the flip chart, and both teams were 1-15, were side by side. And he's, you know, that, you know, most coaches, you know, look at that England side. I mean, look at those names there. Johnson, Dallaglio, Rodber, Hill, you know, that. Why do we want anybody else in our team? That's our England team. And we all of us looked at Austin as if to say, well, probably have Jonah more than you, Oz. But to Austin's credit, he put his hand up and said, Clive, I would have Jonah in my team all day long. Sorry about that. He's always very good at being self-deprecating.
Then losing in that tournament, how did that prep you, apart from the training, going forward? Looking at 2003, it's 4 years away. What have you learned from 99?
Well, I mean, it was pretty immediate. When we had a very quick debrief in Paris after the game, where we were, you know, understandably peed off. And Clive pretty much set the challenge there. I was like, guys, some of you are going to make it, some of you aren't. It was like, I don't even know where I'll be in 4 years' time, but I want to be. And I'm going to dedicate myself to making sure that we're going to win it in 2003. I mean, he was pretty bullish, you know, which is an easy thing to say, but he was making it very apparent to us that, you know, there were a lot of things that were in our control that we didn't bring to the party and perform in. And that, you know, there wasn't a lack of effort or training or physicality. It was the little, as he would call them, one percenters, whether it's, you know, how you communicate with your team, little cliques, doing the basics well. How much were you really prepared to sacrifice? Could you have trained harder? Could you have made better decisions? All the little things that everybody talks about. But he was quite angry and was, guys, please don't bother coming back unless you're prepared to absolutely throw yourself at it for 4 years. And he kept that fire lit over that four-year period. And players were coming and going, and be in the team, be out of the team. If your performance wasn't up to standard, you know, he'd set the bar very, very high, because he believed that's where we faltered somewhat, and that we were just a little bit hot and cold, where we needed to be the best team in the world, have the best basics and drills in the world, and best coaches, best management, best players, best combination, best basics, then we were going to be with a chance.
And then with that high standard, you were kind of in and out of the starting lineup squad. I know Clive sent you a Christmas card at one point.
Yeah, I was captain in 2000, 2001, thinking that everything was tickety-boo, going in the right direction. But then got distracted around the captaincy and getting all the corporate attention and sponsors and media, and, you know, and just lost my focus on the game. I really enjoyed captaincy. I think it brought out some of the best rugby that I've ever played for England. But I just got ahead of myself a little bit. And, you know, Clive pulled me up, sent me notes and cards saying, you know, one occasion I remember him saying, you know, you've got a lot of work to do to even get back in the squad. You're probably my number five scrum half in the country.
Jesus.
Yeah. Right, okay. And of course, I'm angry and I'm disagreeing with him. And rather than accepting it and thinking, why is he saying that? But then there was a coach called Wayne Smith who came in. He was my coach 2001, 2002, maybe at Northampton. He was really good at, whereas Clive was quite blunt and this is how it is, deal with it. Smithy was, he came in and gave me some home truths, but in a sort of like a fatherly or a big brother type role.
What were the home truths?
My head was, you know, stuck at my rear a little bit because I was doing a lot of media and corporate and everyone's patting you on the back and saying how great you are because they see you doing this, that and the other. So yeah, I just, you know, lost a lot of focus, but then Smithy really took it on himself to put his arm around me, and then he started to make me help him with the coaching, doing loads of analysis on the teams. And Northampton would never have known that I was necessarily doing all of that analysis, but Smithy was tapping into my skill set because he just, you know, he saw that I was pretty good at that. So we'll just use that, but we don't need to talk about that in front of the players. And he would present it and I would, you know, go away and do my homework, bring it back to him. And I was starting to ground myself a little bit more, which was generally very good for me, really good for me. And you know, it stood me in good stead, really, for the rest of my life after that. It was good.
Really? Wayne Smith had that much?
Oh, 100%. Smithy. So Ian McGeek in my early years at Northampton, Smithy, 100%. Sean Edwards at Wasps. And Clive, no question about that. I wouldn't have necessarily recognised that from Clive at the time. That's more reflective for me. I look back and think he was absolutely brilliant for me. But because of where I was in my own mind, I was biting back and not necessarily reacting. Thankfully, I did eventually, it clocked with me why he was being who he was to me. But there were a few years where I was just thinking, you know, well, I'm absolutely screwed. He hates me, or I can't work him out. I didn't have the backup around me to say, well, hold on a minute, maybe he's doing that because he's going to get you over here. I didn't have that part of the puzzle worked out in my mind.
You couldn't quite see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Going into the 2003 World Cup, you guys are really going in off some good form. And I think it was the Grand Slam in Dublin.
It was a massive game for England, that. Huge. People talk about the going down and beating New Zealand and Australia in the summer before the World Cup, which, you know, of course, winning away from home was really important. But the pressure we put on ourselves to win that Grand Slam game in 2003, effectively saying to ourselves, if we don't win this game, we're not going to win the World Cup. This is the game that you have to prove yourselves. It just cemented it all together that we were absolutely on the right charge here. We were in the right line. We, you know, all that shenanigans about the red carpet.
Yeah, what happened there?
Well, the people told us to go and stand on that side. We'd warmed up that side. The guy in the tunnel said, right, go out, run right. Yeah, fine, we went out, run right. So then they come in and say, oh, no, yeah, that's where Ireland stand. Well, you've just told us to stand here. We're not going anywhere. And the rumour would go down the line that they're trying to get us to move. And then,
like Chinese whispers would go all the way down.
We'd send it back, tell him to not move. We're staying exactly where we are. I didn't even realise that the Irish team were so intent on standing on the left that they actually walked behind us or something and stood on the left, so off the red carpet.
What?
At the time, I mean, I've seen it on TV loads of times, but at the time, I don't even remember that. For us, it was just nothing. Nothing whatsoever. It just John O'Sullivan going, we're not going to be the mugs here. You have told us to stand here and this is what we're doing, and now you're trying to mess us around and move us. No, if you made a mistake, suck it up, get on with it. And that, and you know, it sort of epitomised what that team were like. You know, they were uncompromising. We were stubborn. No one was going to mess around with us. Certainly, no one was going to mess around with Jono. And you know, we were not going to budge. Didn't matter whether we were playing away from home. You're getting booed at, jeered at. It's like, no, this is why we're here, to do what we do, and you're not going to knock us off course. Whereas if I was captain, Would I have moved? Well, maybe, yeah. Maybe the nature of me would have gone, well, I don't want to maybe upset everyone. Let's move, you know. Would that have been the right thing, wrong thing? I don't know. But, it, you know, looking back on it, if we had moved, is it slightly submissive? Then maybe it is. You know, all those mind games that play around it, was John was like, absolutely not. We're not going anywhere.
It's so good. Made you guys so unlikable, though.
Yeah.
Then you come down.
We quite like that.
Yeah, you did. And you did the Southern Hemisphere tour. How important were those games for you to win?
The last piece of the puzzle for that England squad, we'd got to number one in the world. We were beating Southern Hemisphere teams at Twickenham. The only piece in the puzzle was that we'd not won in New Zealand. Can't remember whether we'd won in Australia. You know, that was where the World Cup was going to be. This was a genuine marker to the rugby world that not only are we the number one team in the world, but it doesn't matter where we're doing it. And Phil Larder, the defensive coach, saying to us, this is semi-final, final rugby. For England, this is the mentality. New Zealand semi-final, Australia is the final. Knockout, have to win them. It's in an environment that you're going to be doing. You're going to be down here in however many months' time. We were probably more ready in that June, July, August than we were actually in the World Cup.
I remember we were pretty confident. We had some pretty good outside backs. We had Carlos and his pomp as well.
The trouble is those sorts of players, the way that England were in that day and how we defended, the flashier the fly half, the better.
Really?
Oh, my God. That was meat and drink for England because we were so good defensively. It was so high line and real hard press. You know, you look at the French fella, Michelac, and then who would have been in Australia? Was it Larkham?
Larkham.
Those playmakers, we were just like, we pride ourselves on getting stuck into nines and tens. Whenever we had training sessions and board sessions in meeting rooms.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
The key individuals to stifle, stop at source, 9 and 10. Whatever we're going to do, how are we going to get stuck into 9 and 10? Who's going to apply pressure to 9 and 10? So we're seeing people like Carlos, you know, flicking it through their legs and doing all the fancy. We were like, yeah, keep doing that all day long.
Let's fast forward to the World Cup and actually get back to Australia. You go in, I think you guys were training for like 2-3 months at least. I saw your training regime. You're starting at 7 a.m. in the morning, finishing at God knows what hour each night. But you guys were, I know professionals living and breathing rugby full time, but you guys were, there was nothing else going on in your lives apart from being in this training camp, training day in, day out, all day, every day for like 2-3 months.
Yeah, they probably see it as relatively normal now, but you know, that was a massive transition. To be part of that from sort of amateur to professional with a small p to full on as it would be now, I bet you it wouldn't be too different to how it is now. And that's, you know, very early starts, getting in the gym, nutrition, skills training, nutrition, team training, nutrition. We weren't allowed out of our rooms between 2 and 4 o'clock or something. We were told we had to sleep. It's like no one was allowed in the corridors, no one was allowed in the team rooms. So you had to then sleep from 2 till 4. Then you would get up and do another fitness session or teams. I mean, we were
Dad's army. You would have loved having that afternoon nap.
Oh yeah, I loved the nap. Still do. I reckon we must have been doing 4 or 5 sessions a day. Must have been. And then you got all your recovery, and then up doing it again. It was mind blowingly numb, and yet just to show how simple we would be. I think it was a Friday before we'd have a weekend off in the summer. We knew that last thing on Friday would be, a horrible fitness session where people would be stopping and being sick and all the rest of it. But there was one of those coolers full of Cornettos at the end. So, I mean, that was like our gold at the end of the rainbow. It's pathetic, really.
Let's get into the World Cup now then. You go through pool play. You've got that one big game against South Africa, which is the one that you have to win. You win that. Then you get into the quarterfinals. You face Wales in the quarterfinal. That was the first real moment you guys thought, maybe this isn't going to go to plan.
There was a huge focus on South Africa because we knew if we came top of the group, then we would be playing Wales in the quarterfinals opposed to New Zealand, I think. And in effect, it gives you a slightly different run-in, but a run-in that you'd think, Wales, France, somebody, that could be quite interesting. Mentally, we didn't give enough respect to Wales in that tournament. Wales, Shane Williams and the like were, just throwing everything around, playing a real different style of rugby because they knew they couldn't play the heavy physical stuff up front. Mm. So they were just playing sevens. We were underprepared strategically in that first half. We trained pretty hard in the week. Some would argue we trained too hard and we didn't necessarily have everything in the tank. That first half, Wales ran as ragged and just, kept the ball alive through course to the wind. Shane Williams running around like a lunatic and sidestepping everyone, and all the Welsh team were in sync. We got into that half-time and Clive made a change, took Dan Luger off, brought Mike Catt on. And I think because that style of game suits Catty, he loves to play. So there was a little bit, right, we'll meet fire with fire here. Whereas I think Johnny was a bit more conservative. Catty was like, well, if his game's going to open up, I'm going to take it on. And he was making breaks and finding holes and distributing really well. I mean, Catty was magnificent in that game, that second half. And then we had, because it broke up a little bit, Jason Robinson does his little break, gives it to Will Green, who scores in the corner, and Wales start to run out of steam a little bit. We kick a few goals, the game's done. But it was a huge half-time, probably the biggest half-time in Clive's career, I would say.
What did he say?
Whether it's necessarily anything that he's said, but it was just the decision to do what he did.
He had to take action.
With selection, at half-time, which didn't happen very often. Maybe to getting into the second half, but to sit there and say, right, we definitely need to shift the way that we're playing here and the intensity of how we're playing. And to, slightly move Johnny away from that limelight and get Catty involved more and more was a big move. You don't want to dent Johnny's confidence. So how he handled all of that was brilliant.
In the media after that game, there was a players give coach an ultimatum headline about something around you guys training too hard going into that. Was that what happened? Or
It certainly wasn't an ultimatum. It was more of a, Jono would never say anything unless it was warranted. Never. Jono would always be very calculating and thoughtful about what he needs to say. And, we did a debrief straight away after the game that night. And, it just came out that we were a bit leggy. We'd done a lot of training, played a lot of rugby already, and Wales came out and played this fast, furious game, whereas we were a bit more forward-oriented and we were leggy. And so we needed to manage the next week. If you were France, you would potentially look at the way that Wales played to say, oh, well, hold on a minute, that caused England some trouble. Maybe we should
100%,
employ some of those tactics. So we needed to have everything in the tank going into that semi-final.
So you start dialing back the training, doing a lot more walkthroughs and that kind of thing. You get through the semi-final. Let's go to the World Cup final. How are you managing your emotions going into that game? Because when you look at a Rugby World Cup final for a rugby player, there simply isn't another game that comes close to it as far as being the pinnacle of your career. How are you sleeping the night before? How are you controlling your emotions?
I mean, is it any different than a semi-final? Yeah, okay, marginally. You know, the big games, huge games. Is it any different than sleeping the night before a Grand Slam decider? You know, marginally. But you know, you'd go through those, you know, those practices of, you know, whether you're staying up. I would always stay up late, take half a sleeping tablet, stay up late, and then crash and burn and sleep through. You know, making sure your nutrition's right. You know, the emotion around the World Cup final is often created by other people around you. So whether it's the fans singing all night and, you know, partying, and your people just, you know, making loads of noise and just enjoying themselves, it is making you think, oh my God, yeah, this is the World Cup final. Or Paul Grayson writes me a most amazing letter of friendship and love, and, you know, reminiscing over times and re-emphasizing why I am where I am and because of how I've played, or, you know, giving me visual cues and all this sort of stuff. You know, that doesn't normally happen. So they're the bits that just tip you over. And whether it's a Grand Slam decider or a semi-final, you know, these are the, you know it's not going to get any bigger than this. But you know, you're still well practiced in preparing for those big games.
So the day starts, you get to Stadium Australia, the Olympic Stadium, where they had the Olympics in Sydney. And you arrive there on the bus. Is it just following a normal process then? Is it just, it's another game?
Well, yeah, we'd had the semi-final the week before, so the environment is familiar, how they set up the changing room.
Were you surprised that it was Australia in the final and not the All Blacks?
The All Blacks, they weren't a great team. They were nowhere near the greatness of 7, 11 and 15.
Mm.
Australia had some like proper superstars in their team. They had game breakers in their team. It was just whether they had the grunt up front. And against New Zealand, you know, it got quite loose. The game got quite loose. And the Aussies were Takiri, Rogers, Larkham,
Green. Mortlock.
You know, they had some people who could break the line and cause havoc.
It's actually a good point with Gregan. Like, cause obviously you're marking Gregan in the final. And it was that game in the semi-final when he has the famous four more years, boys, to the All Blacks. Did he have much chirp for you in the final?
Oh, all the time. George, he's a good mate, and playing against each other for what seemed like forever. So, yeah, we had plenty of exchanges.
Anything memorable in the final?
I mean, I remember giving him a little bit when Tins picked him up and properly dumped him on his ass. But funnily enough, not in the final, because Andy Robinson, the forwards coach, had pulled me aside in the week because he knew that I knew George. He had noticed that those games that I play and I know the scrum half, that if I get familiar with the scrum half in game time, before the game, when we're warming up, you walk past him, give him a little high five or whatever. It was like, I don't want any of that. I want steely face, absolute ignoring your opposite number. Take them out of their comfort zone because they're going to think that they can come up and say hello, Dawson, you know, whatever.
Right.
And so that was the first time that I think I'd ever played against George Gregan where I completely like blanked him before the game, in the warm-up, in the tunnel, you know, for crossing, because you do tend to cross paths quite a lot, even when you're going out for a pitch inspection with the program and having a wander around or, you know, absolutely zero. So I gave him nothing because, and he was right. For whatever percentage of that, George Gregan would have thought Dawson's been a bit of a dick. But then it just changes the dynamic slightly. But yeah, I mean, that was absolutely part of the brilliance of George, that he would properly, like we all did, we'd wind up the opposition and, you know, get stuck into the referee and.
You get into the game, Australia strike first.
Yeah, they're
freaking out a bit.
Good set piece move. I've obviously practiced that a few times. I'm surprised they never did it again, to be honest. But and in a weird kind of way, it kick-started England. When it was very early on, we were sparring slightly. It then instilled this sort of frenzy. And bearing in mind, we hadn't played that well. Only played well the second half. France, second half, we played pretty well. But it wasn't like we were playing like we were in the summer against Australia and New Zealand and Benny Cohen scoring tries, all that stuff, or against Ireland in the Grand Slam. We weren't playing like that. Even the warm-up games against France, we were brilliant, played some amazing rugby. It was some of the most fantastic rugby I've played for England. But in the World Cup, we were so pragmatic, but we were slightly stifling ourselves. Anyway, that try sort of kicked us up the arse to say, right, any time now, start playing some rugby, because if you don't, this is what the Aussies are going to do and they're going to win. And we didn't want that first half to finish. Absolutely not. Robbo scores his try. Benny Kaye coughed that try up in the corner.
Oh, dear.
But we were causing havoc, opportunities, left, right and centre. We could have scored three tries there. We should have scored two, probably should have scored three. And in the second half, we got refereed out of the game, couldn't get any momentum. Never really got in the game. Got to the end of regular time and, Jono pulls us in. It's like we'd not even out of breath. It's like, what? We've just done nothing there for 40 minutes. Right, we need to sort of discipline out. Jace has come on, sort the scrum, no penalties, get ourselves in position.
Wilkinson was like practicing his kicks while Jono was talking to you, right?
I don't even think we'd had a shot at goal. So Johnny's gone 40 minutes without a kick at goal. So he's like on cold turkey, he's needing to practice because he knows he's going to probably have to do it at some stage.
Smart.
And that penalty in the first period of extra time was, 45 metres out, right-hand side, and he slotted that. It was a massive, massive kick. Big, big kick for us. We were right, okay, we're in the game here, no problem. And then, of course, the second half was getting a little bit twitchy. Andre Watson was given as nothing, gives them a penalty at scrum time, which, just England were all over the Aussies in scrum time. It was embarrassing. But he kept penalising us. And we just didn't get in out of probably third gear. Just couldn't click. But again, when Flatley scores that penalty to draw level, again, it was like another
17-all
moment. Yeah, where not that we loved our backs against the wall, but we'd got used to this environment where now and again certain things would really piss us off to say, right now, focus, this is what we've got to do. And I think because it went down to that last 2 minutes, we've been here before, we've practiced, this is what we're supposed to do. Could everybody just tune in and get this thing done from kicking it long? I mean, that was all planned, kick the ball long, Lewis Moody would chase. They would kick it out, our line out. And we'd done that in training time after time after time. That was the drill. From the very first kickoff to now the last kickoff with 2 minutes to go, the World Cup final. Then we knew that they would mark up the front because that's where Jono was. And they did it in the Lions Tour in 2001 and they nicked it. And we sold them down the river to say, we're going to go down the front, throw it to the back where it's an easy catch. And then we were just into our drop goal routine.
Zigzag.
Of that, zigzag routine. Hit it up left, hit it up right. Let's just make little yardage. It just so happens that Justin Harrison got slightly too wide looking at Johnny. I've then made a dart, which is part of the zigzag. Will and Robbo come in to win it. Then Jono takes it up as part of the zigzag. Australia are panicking now because they're in their own 22. They're on edge. I just go down and have like a little body feint, bring them offside, and then I pass it when they're on the retreat. So Johnny gets an extra, we've done it. And we just did it time after time after time in games, in training. I cannot emphasize enough how
that situation was ingrained in you guys already.
It was just like it was a routine. It was an absolute routine that we believed we could do at any time. And we had done in lots of games. Someone could find lots of footage of us doing exactly the same setting up Wilco for a drop goal. Now, going all the way back to 99, when Clive sat the leadership group in a meeting and said to the leadership group, how many drop goals would it take to win a test match? And basically saying, what if we didn't go for tries? What if we just, whenever we got into the 22, we just set Wilco up to hit a drop goal. And then went back to the halfway. And then went back and then got to the 22 and kicked a drop goal. From that moment that Flatley kicked the ball over and we're walking back to the halfway line and we're calling the move, so every 15 players from England know exactly where they should be, what they'll be doing and what the outcome's going to be. Not we're going for a try, you know, we're going to get to near the 22 and Johnny's going to hit a drop goal. The opposition knew that we were going to be doing it. The fans knew what we were going to do it. But because every single England player just didn't question and just, we know where the line out is, we know where the ruck's going to be, going to go and win the ruck. If there is a break, we know how to adapt.
Then you take a wee snipe.
Well, that was part of zigzag. If I passed the ball to someone, they made a line break, then everybody would be going into that ruck and we'd analyse whether, are we close enough? Is it easy for Johnny or whatever? If there's a gap for a scrum half to go through, he goes through. And then, we still get into that pattern. It happened to pan out that because that was a clean line break, we made 10 or 15 yards, got really close to the posts. So the next ruck was going to be the drop goal. The key part was Jono, in the split second, realising that I was at the bottom of the ruck and he would want the 9 passing to the 10. So he took it up and didn't try and over-elaborate, just got the ball and recycled it for 5 or 6 seconds for me to get on my feet. And then you're in that position that you've practised 1,000 times with your fly half. Some would say, oh, that was a bit risky to try and break the line. It was the right thing to do because there was a gap there. All the Aussies are focusing on Wilco, thinking that we're going to go to Johnny for the drop goal straight away. There's a gap for me to go. The rest of the team come in. I think it's Will Greenwood and Jason Robinson come in to win the first ruck. Then Jono takes the ball up and we're sort of doing a mini zigzag there as well. But then Johnny to call for the ball. So it might have looked slightly disjointed, but we've done that hundreds and hundreds of times in practice and in games.
And then you bang it to Johnny.
Yeah, well, he'd missed a couple that day already, so I think he was as frustrated as the rest of us that a few hadn't gone over. But yeah, I mean, he was just so unbelievably assured and solid. And people would say, he's left-footed, he did it with his right foot. But he honestly, when you were practicing on the training park, if I was on the left-hand side of the post, he would want it on his right foot because it's a straighter drop goal. If we're on the right-hand side of the post, he wants it on his left foot because it's a straight drop goal. I mean, it wasn't like he was always trying to get it on his left foot or if I've got to do it on my right, I will. He had this genuine ability. He was just equally good off both feet. So, I mean, he was incredible talent. Incredible to be able to pass that. And people wouldn't necessarily know or understand the difference, but passing it onto his left foot in that angle might give the opposition another half a second, which they can cover 2 yards. So, he always wanted it in the slot so he could just, drop goal it straight away, opposed to having to shift his body and be in a different angle, be slightly wider, all those things. He was just so thorough and analytical about how he wanted to kick the ball.
It's so detailed, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So you just do as you're told.
So he told
you. He wants it here. I'll put it there for you.
So you were deliberately throwing to exactly where he wanted it on that foot.
100%, yeah. And not all fly halves were like that. I can't think of any other players in the world that were like that. Not even the greats. Not even Dan Carter's of this world.
If you think of Carter's drop goal against Australia, he switched over because he's left-footed. He switched over to his left foot and banged that one over.
Yeah. And sort of caught it on his right and then moved on to his left.
Yeah.
Whereas Wilco just would have hit it with his right.
Do you guys think you won the World Cup at that point? You've still got the kickoff to go though.
The footage will show you there weren't crazy celebrations when it went over. If anything, it was we were all sprinting back, right, get into position where but it was chaos. Because all of the Aussies were everywhere. Some were on the right, some were on the left, some were down the middle. They needed to get the ball back. we were trying to cover all bases, and then they kicked it off quick, and Trevor Woodman was standing, why he was standing in the middle of the field, I'll never know. But, you know, a prop leaps above everyone and catches it. You know, no one mentions that, but it was so important. When we then caught the kickoff, knew the clock had gone and just absolutely smash it into the stands. I think we used to say kick it in the green seats, because I think that's that stems from at Twickenham, where obviously the seats are green, but they're behind like the advertising hoarding. So the focus is very much a long way in touch opposed to just in touch. So it was like hit the green seats, yeah.
So you've won the World Cup. What's going through your head? What's the emotions? You just lay down and
I think I grabbed hold of Mike Catt, gave him a big hug, and then before you know it, Paul Grayson, who was sat with all the subs, and he came on, and then you just picking your player as you're going around, and that disbelief and amazement and joy and happiness, you know, probably quite. Sort of selfish from an England point of view, you know, you're seeing the Aussie players and seeing how upset they are, and you're saying, you know, congratulations on a great game, but in the same breath you want to jump around for joy and
it's your moment,
celebrate with your teammates. Yeah, took a good few minutes, I suppose, to sink in, because you weren't letting it sink in. It was the relief and the joy of winning the game and winning the World Cup that you dreamt about and trained for. But then it's, you know, even within 5 minutes where you have just a quick, what's just happened here? Right, where are my parents? We all wanted to see our friends and family. And, you know, you see them bringing out the presentation platforms and, you know, watching the crowd go completely bonkers. You know, all of that process takes 5-10 minutes. And even then, when they're doing the ceremony and you're all on the, when Jono holds a trophy up and you're doing all the pictures and parading around, you know, it probably wasn't until I was with my mum and dad and the other parents and, you know, that sort of realisation of what's gone on and what's happened. But then you go back to doing a lap of honour with the trophy and pictures and going bonkers and celebrating and going into the changing room and all the hoi polloi coming in and the
Prince Harry
and politicians and, you know, anybody who could get themselves an invite. We're getting themselves an invite, but we didn't care. We were just, you know, drinking and celebrating. The phone's going banana. You know, it's old school analog phone, and you're just getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of text messages. There's no social media or anything. It's just, you know, your phone's going bananas.
What do you make of the England team's chances for this World Cup?
I think this World Cup will have something just a little bit different about it. I think the rule book gets ripped up this time round. I think there is a real possibility Ireland, France, New Zealand, South Africa are probably my top four, but able to win it. I think England are able to win it. Australia are able to win it. You know, you've got six teams there that, you know, really, I think, have a proper chance at winning it. France at home are going to be really tough to beat. You know, South Africa and New Zealand will be sick to death of everyone talking about Ireland and France. But New Zealand and South Africa will have a part to play in that story for sure, yeah.
And you're going to be going from a hospitality perspective, aren't you?
With it being so handy for the UK, I'll be there working for the BBC. I'll be there working for STH. I'll be there enjoying the hospitality. I'll be there seeing the country with all the fans. You know, the hospitality is a massive part of rugby. It's quite aspirational because people who have had a taste of that official hospitality around World Cups know that it's like an integral part of the game. It gets everybody in a very, very different mood, ready for the game. It's not just about sort of turning up to a normal fixture, getting in the stands and watching the game. It's, you know, the amazing facilities of the hospitality. It's meeting some of the players that have played in World Cups in years gone by. It's the atmosphere that those incredible facilities can create. It's the, you know, having a few drinks, it's eating amazing food, it's talking about the game that's going to happen in a couple of hours' time, you know, and then all of a sudden you're going in to watch it, and then you can go back and start reviewing how the game's gone, and people are happy, people are sad. It creates a much more sort of rounded rugby day than just going to watch the rugby. You can't experience it in any other way. You can't get it from listening to the radio, watching TV, or watching it on a big screen. It's, you know, being there the whole day and having that incredible experience of hospitality and match day is very, very special.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Very jealous. Enjoy the World Cup and thanks for coming on the show.
It's an absolute pleasure. What's the name of the show?
Andy Rowe Show.
It is very simple.
There you go.
The Andy Rowe Show.
It's a self-branding exercise.
Yeah, it is. I need a very self-indulgent, that is, isn't it?